All right, we're ready for John chapter 11 in our study this morning. We take again a look at our outline we borrow from Baxter, and we are still in the first major section of the book having to do with the public ministry to the Jews, and actually I should have moved that down. We're in the third subsection, that is the witness and the cleavage. That is, there are those who cleave to the Lord and there are those who depart from him. We'll see more about a turning point in our study this morning in chapter 11. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1, Jesus is the true light. Chapter 2, focused on his power and authority. Chapter 3, teacher come from God, a quote from Nicodemus. Chapter 4, all right, testimony to the Samaritans and the Galileans. Chapter 5. All right, yeah, witnesses for Christ. Very good. Chapter 6. He's the bread of life. Good. Chapter 7 focuses on controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. So controversy begins. Chapter 8. All right, yes, he's the light of the world who deals with a dark nation. Here's that controversy again, and Jesus is dealing with that. Chapter 9. All right, the blind see and the seeing are blinded. And then chapter 10, last time. He is the good shepherd. So we dealt with 9 and 10 in our studies last time. Question number 1, what's chapter 11 all about? All right, Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Key verse would be verse 25, where he said, I am the resurrection and the life. And thus, that's what this chapter is all about. Now, let's go to question number 8. What does I'm the resurrection and the life mean? Verse 25. It's one thing to say he is. Go ahead. All right. He's the source of the resurrection. He will be raised himself. He can raise others. He's about to demonstrate. What else? We only have life through him. He is the source of eternal life. We're going to see several things in the context there in a moment. We'll develop that even a little further later on. Four things happen in chapter 11. We have a death, we have a visit, we have a resurrection, and we have a plot. The death of Lazarus is the occasion to demonstrate that he is the resurrection and the life. The visit that Jesus makes to the house of Lazarus, to the scene of Lazarus' death, to the tomb of Lazarus, I should say, he visits with an explanation that he is the resurrection and the life. That's the section where he makes the point and the heart of the story. Then there is a resurrection, which is the demonstration of the fact he is the resurrection and the life. It's one thing to say, I'm the resurrection and the life. Okay, you said it, but where's the proof? Okay, Lazarus come forth. All right, there you go. He is the resurrection and the life. And then now there's a plot. There is a reaction. Some people believe, but then they're dead set now on killing him because of that. They've tried already twice and failed. And yet now they're ready to do it in full measure. So that's what we're going to be seeing here in this context. Let's go to question number 2. Why did the disciples not want Jesus to go, verses 7 through 10? They thought he's going to be killed because they've made 2 attempts already in our recent context, and they're ready to go full measure. All right, let's talk about the death being the occasion. Let's start here with the man described in verses 1 and 2. Here is the death. Now, the death hadn't occurred yet. We know it's going to because we've read ahead, but assuming we haven't got that far, what we see at the beginning is at verse 1, there was a certain man who was sick. His name was Lazarus, and he was of the city of Bethany. We'll say more about Bethany in a moment. And this was the town of Mary and her sister Martha. We'll come back to verse 2 in just a moment. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were close to Jesus. They were a very close relationship. He loved them, according to verse 5 and verse 4. He was sick. What's the nature of his sickness? I don't know, but it was apparently very serious, because within just a day or two he died. And he was in need of being healed. Now let's talk about Bethany just for a moment here, and then we'll come back to Mary and Martha. This is Bethany right here in the proximity, within 5 miles of Jerusalem or less. 2 miles, according to verse 18. And so that's the Bethany that we're talking about. There is another Bethany that was in Perea. This is where they are, right here in the middle of that circle. But there is, if I can get my red dot here, there is a Bethany in Perea where Jesus was. And you say, how do you know that's where he was? Let's back up to chapter 10 and in verse 40. That he went away again. This is where they sought to seize him and kill him. He went away again beyond Jordan to the place where, beyond Jordan, meaning on the other side of Jordan. So we're on the east side of Jordan. And where John was baptizing at first. Well, that's identified in chapter 1 in verse 28. And your footnote will say that's Bethany, the Bethany on the other side of Jordan. So it's about 25 to 30 miles away. So when they send for Jesus, that's where he is. That makes sense? He's not in close proximity like he's in Jerusalem, 2 miles away, but he's 25 to 30 miles away, which may explain some distance. Some time had to pass. 2 days of travel had to pass. And we'll get to that here a little bit later at verse 29 and on down. All right, so that's the man and the circumstance. And verse 4, or verse 2 says, this was Mary who anointed Jesus with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. That sounds like past tense. It is past tense from the point of writing, not from the point of occurrence. Does that make sense? John is writing toward the end. This may perhaps be the last book to have been written of all the New Testament books. Some disagree with that, but perhaps it was. And if that's the case, he's writing much after this took place. So when did that take place? Well, that takes place after this. Chapter 12, if you've read ahead, chapter 12, verses 1 through 8 is the case of the anointing at Bethany. You say, well, maybe it was out of sequence and this happened before. Verse 1, 2, and 3 talks about Lazarus having been raised and Jesus then appearing there at that house. So this anointing took place after his resurrection. Makes sense? But John is speaking from the vantage point of his writing. This is the same Mary and Martha, this is the same Mary that anointed the feet of Jesus. All right, questions or comments of who the man is and where we're going with him. What's the appeal now at verse 3? His sisters sent to him, some 25 to 30 miles away, come and heal him, the one that that you love is sick. Close relationship here, and he's sick. Now, let's focus on the purpose of this death. Now, we're focusing on the death in verses 1 through 16. We haven't got to his death yet, but what's the purpose of his death here? Well, verse 4, when Jesus heard that, he said, the sickness is not unto death. It doesn't mean he's not going to die. Jesus knew he was going to die. But for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. What does that mean? All right. Yeah, through this resurrection, they don't know that it's going to happen. The disciples don't know that's going to happen. Jesus does know it's going to happen. That through his death, he's sick, so that he would die and we can demonstrate and manifest the glory of God, and God's glorified in that. That it becomes evident that I've been sent from God. Drop down to verse 15. He focuses more on that. He said, I'm glad for your sake. This is after they learn he's dead and Jesus is announcing he's dead. He said, I'm glad for your sake I wasn't there. I'm glad I wasn't like right next to him and then healed him, because then I wouldn't have raised him from the dead. I'm glad I wasn't there. So I can raise him from the dead. I'm paraphrasing verse 15. So that you may believe. So let us go. I'm glad I wasn't there. So we know the man we're talking about. We know the appeal that was made. Come and heal him. Here's the purpose. Now let's talk about the delay. Question number 3. That should be worded a typo. What did the delay of 2 days, verse 6, accomplish? Verse 15. Gave him time to die, gave them time so that some he's been buried for a while. It's not that he actually died, but they think he's just asleep. He's been in the tomb for 4 days by the time they get there. And so it gives an opportunity for the disciples to see evidence and others to see evidence of that. All right, so look at verse 2. Jesus delayed 2 days. Now I want to get ahead of myself. Remember when Martha said, look at verse 21. I said 29 a moment ago. Let's see, verse 21, that he has been in the tomb 4 days. I'm at verse 39, I'm sorry. That he has been in the tomb for 4 days. Well, he delayed for 2 days, according to verse 6, which makes me think that there was a day of travel. Not necessarily the whole day, but it took a day of travel to make that distance of 25 to 30 miles to go summon Jesus, and a day for him to come. That accounts for 2 days, and he delayed 2 days. There's your 4 days he's been in the tomb. And so it's building some time. But he delayed 2 more days. Once he got a message that he's sick, he delayed for 2 days on purpose. Now look at verse 5. His delay was not because of his disinterest. How do I know? Yeah, he loved Martha and her sister, and he also loved Lazarus. He cared about them. It's not that he's disinterested. That's not the purpose. We've already seen the purpose. So beginning at verse 7, after he had said this to the disciples, he said, let us go to Judea again. Now, he's over in Perea. He's left. Why did he leave to start with? Remember chapter 10? Yeah, they'd taken up stones ready to kill him, and he escaped. That was the second time he had done that. And the disciples well knew that, so the disciples contend about how dangerous that is. So they say to him, verse 8, what do they say? Yeah, this is dangerous. You shouldn't go back. This is not reasonable for you to go back. They're going to kill you if you go back. Let's not go. And they urged him not to go. Now, verse 9 and 10 requires a little thinking just for a moment. It's not that it's that difficult. It's just this is part of this disciples contending that it's dangerous and Jesus pushing back on that. He said, are there not 12 hours in a day? Some have argued from that, and I think it's obviously, I don't have to even refute it, but that a day is made up of 12 hours instead of 24, because that's what Jesus said. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the daylight hours. Are there not 12 hours in a day? And anyone who walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. All right, he sets a premise forth that if you're going to function and do things in life, you're going to work in the daylight hours, because in the dark, you're liable to stumble. So you work while there's opportunity. So the point is, the time to do work should not be postponed. You work while it's day. John 9, remember that? You work while it is day, John 9, verse 4. You work while there's daylight hours. You make hay while the sun shines is a proverb we say. You work in the daylight hours because in the darkness you can't do that. All right, now we'll come back to that. I think there's a spiritual application of that as well. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. Simple point. So what's he saying? What he's saying is the time when you work cannot be postponed. In other words, you don't work in the daylight hours, and because there's danger, then let's just wait and do it in the darkness. We don't do that. You work while there's day. You work while the opportunity is rich. You work while you have the opportunity. So the point is, the time for doing my work should not be postponed, just like one doesn't postpone his daylight work to the night hours. And what he's saying in verse 9 and 10, the decision is not made on a whim. In other words, I didn't make this decision on a whim that, hey, let's go back to Judea. Let's go back there to Jerusalem. Hadn't thought it through. Let's just go. But he's thinking in harmony with keeping his mission. Does that make sense? There's work to do. There's opportunity. And I'm going to work while the sun is shining. Now, is there a spiritual application of that at verse 9? And obviously that you work while the day is, and because he sees the light of the world, etc. But I think he's driving home the principle to the disciples who are saying, don't go. I've got to use the opportunity that is afforded when the opportunity is right to do what's right. And I'm making this decision in harmony with my mission. It wasn't made on a whim. Does that make sense? This was not a careless decision that let's go back to Judea. Let's go. They've called for me to come to see Lazarus. Let's go. Make sense? All right, now beginning at verse 11, Jesus said, we must go wake Lazarus. Let's see what this is about. He said these things, and after he said, our friend Lazarus sleeps, and I must go wake him up. How'd the disciples respond? Yeah, if he's sleeping, he's going to be all right. So why do we need to go? That's kind of pushing back again. There's no need for you to go if he's asleep, if that's the problem. However, he spoke of death, but they thought he was speaking of taking a rest in sleep. And so Jesus plainly said to them, so we're all clear and we understand, Lazarus is dead. He's dead. That's what I'm talking about. And I'm glad for your sake that I wasn't there that you might believe, that you would understand what I'm talking about. Now, what was Thomas's reaction to that? All right, what's he saying? They think, yes, that perhaps Jesus is walking into the face of death, and this seems to be commitment on Thomas's part, that he's determined to go in spite of the danger. If he's going and he's going to face death, let's go with him. And let's go. He says, go, let's go. And we'll go in spite of the danger. And he's not going to face death immediately there. So here we have the death as the occasion. We have the man, we have the appeal, we have the purpose, and there was a deliberate delay so that the manifestation of his glory could be revealed. Questions or comments on that? He wasn't then. Good point. Yeah, it was. All right, let's look at question number number 5. What did the raising of Lazarus prove? Verses 24 to 27. All right, proves he's the resurrection and the life. All right. What else? Proved he's deity. Had power over death. Anything else? All right. That's true. Question number 6, list any lessons you learned from the fact that Jesus wept. We'll get to that here in a second. He has compassion. He cares. There is the humanity element. Yeah, shows his humanity, not just deity, but he was humanity. All right, let's start with verse 17. We'll get all of that here in just a second. Let's talk about Lazarus' situation at verse 17. When Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. We've explained how the 4 days come to play. Delayed for 2 and perhaps a travel day and a travel day, making 4 days. And so it's well established he's dead. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem about 2 miles. And I want to focus here. Let's get where we're headed with this, and then we'll work through the story. This is Jesus' explanation when he gets there. He comes with a visit, but he comes with an explanation. Here's what's going to be done, number one. Here's what that means, and here's how much I care. Does that make sense? Now, there's some other details, so let's get those details, beginning at verse 19. Bethany is about 2 miles from Jerusalem. Many of the Jews had joined Mary and Martha to comfort them concerning their brother. And Martha, as soon as she heard Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. She went out a little distance. We'll see that a little bit later in the context. But Mary stayed in the house. And Martha said to him, what'd she say? Verse 21. Yeah, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. We know your power. We know what you could do. We know what you're capable of. And if you had been here, he would not have died. But even now I know whatever you ask of God, he will give you. What do you think she means by that? Do you think she was expecting a resurrection? Diane suggests maybe. I'm not thinking she thought that he's going to raise him. Maybe she did. Yeah. All right, look at verse 23. I'm going to come back to verse 22. Verse 23 says, your brother will rise again. All right, so here's what's going to be done. He's visited with an explanation. I've come now. He's been dead. You say I could have healed him if I'd been here. That's true. But he's going to rise again. Now, verse 24 through 27. She says at verse 24, I know that he will rise again at the resurrection of the last day. I don't think she was thinking he's about to immediately be raised. But she recognizes his power. Whatever you say, whatever you do, it will be done. But I don't think she's expecting an immediate resurrection, because the first thing she thinks of, I got it. You say he's going to rise again. Same thing you would think if at a death of your loved one at the funeral home, somebody says, well, they'll rise from the dead. You're going to say, well, sure, I know that in the end of time. That's going to happen. I got that. I understand that. But they're not about to get out of this casket. That's not going to happen. So Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Let's go back to question number 5 if you have your answers there. We're going to talk about what all that means. I am the resurrection and the life, and he who believes in me, though he shall die, he shall live. Perhaps that's twofold. If he dies spiritually, he can live again spiritually. That's really not what he's talking about, but there's twofold application of that. But if he dies physically, he can live again. And so what am I learning from that? I'm learning if he's the resurrection and the life, he has the power to save people from their sin. Would you agree with that? Number one. Number two, he has the power to raise the dead if he's the resurrection and the life. But that's not all. Look at verse 26. And whoever lives and believes in me, he shall never die. That's talking about eternal life. He can save people from their sins, he can raise the physical dead, and he can give them eternal life. If he's the resurrection and the life, those three principles are true. Does that make sense? I am the resurrection and the life. I want you to understand that, Jesus is saying to Mary. I want you to understand this concept, or Martha rather, that I am indeed the resurrection and the life. And so he turns to her and asks, do you believe this? And what's her response? Yes, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. So I believe you are the Messiah that was foretold in the Old Testament. I believe you are the Son of God, your deity. And I believe you're in your deity in the flesh. That's who I believe you to be. I'm convinced of that. Which tells me why she has the confidence of verse 22. So what does it mean? He comes with an explanation. I'm going to raise him, though she doesn't understand that. And here's what that means. I have the power to save. I have the power to raise the dead. And I have the power to give eternal life. And furthermore, it proves I'm the Son of God and I'm the Messiah. A lot packed in that. Make sense? All right. Now, let's start at verse 28. And this is a demonstration of how much he cares. So when he had said these things, she went her way. And where'd she go? Went and got Mary. She went secretly to Mary and said, the teacher has come and is calling for you. The record of him calling for her is not mentioned here or not told to us. It's just the fact that she reports that. So he's calling. He wants to talk to you. And so she arose quickly and took off. And Jesus had not yet come into town. And so a little distance out in a place where Mary, Martha had met him, she goes out to meet him. So she goes out of town for a little ways. Who went with her? Verse 31. All the guests that are sitting in the house, mourning with her, they say, well, she perhaps is going to the graveyard, going to the tomb, and so to weep there, so we'll go. So when she came to Jesus, she fell down at his feet, and she says the same thing. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus saw her weeping, and what happens now at verse 33? Yeah, he's groaned in the spirit. Now, some commentators take that in the direction he's groaning about the Pharisees. He's groaning about the rejection. I don't think so. I think he's groaning about death. He's disgusted at death and what death is and what it does and the sorrow it brings. And so he groaned, the text says, verse 33, in the spirit, and he was troubled. And so he asked, where have you laid him? And they take him, and then the text says, Jesus wept. Every young kid has learned that verse when they had to memorize a Bible verse. They wanted the shortest verse in the New Testament. It's actually not the shortest verse in the Greek, but it's the shortest in the English. There's one over in Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians 5 is the shortest in the Greek text for your bit of Bible trivia. You don't get much edification out of that, just a little bit of trivia there. What do you learn from that question? We've already asked that question, but let's go back to question number 6. The fact that if you were there seeing the scene and you look over and Jesus is not just shedding a tear, he's weeping. He's groaning. What do you learn from that? The love that he had. Say again. Yeah, he's just like us. He's a human being with emotions. Good point. Good point. I learned a very practical thing. Real men sometimes cry. This idea that real men don't cry, you got it wrong. Jesus was a real man. And he wept audibly. What was the reaction, verse 36? It's evident to all he cares. Look how much he cared. So here's the explanation Jesus comes with. Here's this Lazarus situation. He's dead. Jesus comes with an explanation. Here's what's going to be done. Here's what that means. And here's how much I care. Now, we're not done with that section. Let's look at the people's expectation. Lazarus' situation, Jesus' explanation, but when he come with that explanation, here was the people's explanation. Back to verse 21, Martha said, you could have healed him, but it's too late. Now that's, I'm paraphrasing, that's not her an exact quote, but isn't that what she's saying? He's dead. And look at verse 31 and 32, that's what Mary said as well. You could have healed him, but it's too late. Verse 37, some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind, remember that, also have kept this man from dying? Three times, he could have been healed, but it's too late. For this man, Jesus, to have any effect on Lazarus, it's too late, they think. There is no evidence that anybody here was expecting a resurrection from the dead. Why did they not say, it's not too late, just go to the tomb and raise him from the dead? So here's Lazarus' situation, Jesus' explanation, and the people's expectation. So let's come to the resurrection, the demonstration of this. Martha seems to be puzzled at first. So let's go to verse 38. Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave. A stone lay against it, and he said, take away the stone. Woods, in his commentary, and he makes, it's an excellent commentary, by the way, on John, makes an observation at 38 and 39 and 41, where he tells them to take away the stone, that he learns from that, and I think it's a good point. God never, deity never does for man what man can do for himself. Did Jesus have the power to move the stone? If he can raise the dead, he can move the stone miraculously. But he didn't do that. He never does for man what man can do for himself. So don't expect God to do things for you that you're capable of doing for yourself. Anyway, there's a stone again. He said, take away the stone. And she pushes back, saying, it'll be a stench because he's been dead 4 days. Well, establishing the fact he's dead. She's puzzled. And so Jesus, how does he push back to her? Verse 40. Didn't I already tell you when I was talking to you outside the city, when you came to meet me, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you'd see the glory of God? Yeah. If I had the power to heal him, don't you understand I have the power to raise him? That may be. Maybe. So at verse 41 and 42, I list here as the Father approves. So what's the point of this? It's not that I can't do this unless I tell you the Father approves, but what he's tying is the connection with the Father to this resurrection. When I raise him from the dead, that's going to prove I came from God. I'm deity. Does that make sense? So he said, when he took away the stone, he lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. Helps if I turn to the right passage when I turn the page. And I know that you always hear me because the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. So I'm mentioning my connection with you so that people, when they see what's about to happen, can have faith. Now then, look at 43 and 44. This must have been surprising. Can you imagine the crowd? He lifted up his voice and cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Can you imagine how strange that would have been? Could you imagine going to a graveyard and you were not expecting a resurrection and some man standing there claiming, I have the power, I'm deity, I'm the resurrection of life, and call your loved one's name and tell him to come forth? You'd think, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Look at verse 44. What happened? He came out. He was bound. And he told them to loose him and let him go. Here's the evidence. He has power over death. All right, let's go to the last section, the plot and the reaction. Verse 45, now, he's come forth from the grave. Here was the demonstration, I am the resurrection and the life. I told you I'm the resurrection and life. Here's evidence of that. Lazarus come forth and he comes to life. Verse 45, what's the first reaction? Many of those Jews who had gathered with Mary and Martha at the house, mourning with her, they had to know of Jesus because he was close to this family. And they had to have knowledge of him, but they might not have had faith in him like they did. And now they saw evidence and they believed. But some went running to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. And so they gathered a council together. That's the Sanhedrin council, the Supreme Court among the Jews. And what did they call the council together to do? What are we going to do with him? What shall we do? For this man works many signs. Notice what they ignore, what the evidence proves, what the signs prove. Let's just ignore that. We got to do something about him because if we let him alone, everyone will believe and the Romans will take both our place and our nation. See, this is based on the idea that Jesus claimed to be a king and they're thinking of an earthly kingdom. Does that make sense? And he's showing signs and people are believing. And if people follow him, then consequently, the Romans are going to react and take our place away from us. We don't want that. And so we got to either kill him or we're going to lose our nation. So Jesus has to die. Now, this is interesting. Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said, you know nothing at all. In other words, you're ignorant. You're ignorant because do you not understand that it's expedient for one man to die for the people and not the whole nation should perish? It's either we kill him or the nation perishes. We're going to lose our nation or kill him one. That's the only two things. They've overlooked a third alternative. The third alternative was to believe him and spare the nation. See, this nation is going, the nation is going to be destroyed, AD 70, isn't it? The Jewish nation is. And it would have been spared had they believed. Overlooks the third alternative. Now, he didn't say that on his own, but him being high priest, what's going on? It's a prophecy that Jesus would die for the nation, that one would die for the nation, and not only for the nation, but for all people who are scattered abroad, for Jews and Gentiles. And so I want you to look at verse 53. They plotted now to put him to death, and from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. And verse 54 says Jesus could walk no longer openly among them. You might make a note at verse 53. This is a turning point in the life of Jesus. From this point on, they are set to kill him. They've tried to kill him before, but they're dead set and determined because the Sanhedrin said he's got to be put to death. We've got to kill him. That's what we got to do. He's got to be put to death. That's for sure. And so now they're plotting to put him. So here's a turning point. From that day on, they are determined. They've got to kill him. And so then, verse 54, from that day forward, he no longer walked openly among the Jews as he had done before. So he went to Ephraim. Where is that? In close proximity to Jerusalem. We don't know the exact location. And so the Passover is close by or nearby in time. What happens now? As they're making their way to the Passover, they're asking, reckon he, is he going to come to the feast? Is he going to show up? And if he does, we'll seize him. And they got the word out. If you see him, let us know. We're going to seize him. So the plot was, many people believed. The Pharisees made a plot, we're going to kill him, and Jesus couldn't walk openly anymore. Chapter makes sense? Jesus is the resurrection of the life. The death is the occasion. Here's the visit with explanation. The resurrection is the demonstration, and here is the plot, the reaction. Yes, ma'am. Exactly. Good point from John chapter 11. Practical things. We've got time for one or two here. Practical things you take home with you. Yeah. Absolutely. Good point. Go to extreme lengths. What else? All right. Good point. God's delay is not neglect. He may be showing his power at another time. We'll... Good point. Good point. We'll stop on that note right there.